What is going on, 1 week season fam? Welcome to the week 10 edition of the OWS Angles podcast. Week 10, that's 9 weeks in the books. That's 8 weeks to go in the regular season. Pretty crazy that we're already at this point. And we're at this point with a slate that is one of my least favorite we've had in a while. Now, least favorite doesn't necessarily mean limited paths to profitability. It just means that the way that I typically play, the things that I typically look for myself, are not things that line up all that well this week. So realistically, this could be one of my least favorite slates and could be one of your most favorite slates. Each of us plays DFS a little bit differently, and each of our minds works a little bit differently in terms of what we look for and what makes the most natural sense to us. So for me, this is not a week I love. With that said, I have essentially taken an analytical approach to this slate and said, okay, what is it about this week that I don't love and how do I work around it? So that's what we're going to be partly working through in this week's Angles podcast. Obviously, we're going to go through our bottom-up build and we're going to hit on some slate angles that I like this week. But before we get into those, I want to talk about what it is about this slate that I don't particularly like. And even if there are things on this slate that you like quite a bit yourself, it's important to talk about this because this ties directly into what we talk about a lot on the site in terms of what it takes to win a tournament, what it takes to get first place in a tournament. So a lot of DFS players make the mistake of, we talk about this all the time, but a lot of DFS players make the mistake of getting too focused on finding good scores, adequate scores, scores that they would feel fine with, scores that keep them on pace for 170, 175 points, maybe even 190 or 200 points. But to take down first place in a tournament, that's almost never going to be enough. Now, if you pay close enough attention or listen to the things that we talk about, you also understand that getting these 220, 230 point scores, that requires some things to break your way. That requires you picking the right game environment more often than not, and that game environment popping off. Or, as we've talked about recently, you know, Joe Mixon scored 45 points that 1 week, and like nobody else scored over 30 that week, if I remember correctly, or maybe only one other player scored over 30 that week. In week two, we were all on Aaron Jones, and he scored whatever it was, 48 or 51 points. And no one was really on him, and then there weren't a lot of other players who popped off. There was the week 7 where whatever it was, 6 or 7 different players popped off for huge games. And so you didn't necessarily need just the exact right player, but you needed multiples of those players in order to have a shot at first place. Last week, there was Davante Adams and Drew Lock and Dalvin Cook and Christian McCaffrey. 2 weeks ago, there was Dalvin Cook. And so there are these scores that can elevate you to this 220, 230 point range. And the way that we find those scores is typically either by finding that blue chip piece that is likelier than a normal player to post that type of score. And so they're typically going to be a popular player, but they just have a higher shot than the field is assuming of that type of score. Now, that doesn't always mean that they're going to be popular. Last week, Christian McCaffrey was underowned. 2 weeks ago, Dalvin Cook was underowned. The Aaron Jones week, he was underowned. The Joe Mixon week, he was underowned. I think Dalvin was about 10%. The other three guys that we just mentioned were 5%, 6% or below. But in each of those spots, we could have looked in retrospect if you didn't have that player, and you could have said, oh yeah, it was pretty clear that this guy had a shot at this type of game based on talent, matchup, opportunity, and price. So in that type of situation, game environment is less important. Obviously, we're talking about a player who just gets an enormous amount of usage and is in the type of matchup where that type of usage can lead them to a huge score. The other way we get these huge scores is finding those game environments that are likely to be back and forth, likely to be high scoring. And from those spots, we can isolate the plays that are likeliest to benefit. Now, the bonus of targeting spots like this is that this allows us to hit on the players we feel best about while also bringing back the players who are likely to succeed if the players we feel best about don't succeed. We talk about that a lot, obviously, but a great example of this was last week. Will Fuller and Brandon Cook stood out in that game environment. If they hit, that meant that the Jaguars were left passing against the Texans, which meant that while most people would be looking at just Cooks and Fuller, and they weren't super popular, I think they were both around 11 or 12% owned or below, but while most people would just be looking at them, we were able to say, okay, if these guys hit, the Jaguars are going to be throwing a lot. They're going to be attacking downfield. They're going to be in a soft matchup. Early in the week, we were on Keelan Cole. And then once Bradley Roby was out, was kind of swung over to DJ Shark. And Shark put up those, what I think it was 30 or 32 points with almost nobody on him. And that's a game environment bet where you're saying, okay, here's a game environment that we like. Concentrated targets. So if things go the way that we're expecting them to go, somebody's going to be putting up a big score. It's what we've talked about with the Vikings several times throughout the season that, you know, Zandermeer's a lot of weeks been running this at least one Vikings per roster rule. I've had a lot of weeks where I've had at least one Vikings player on like 14 out of 19 builds. Again, saying maybe not game environment, but team environment. This team is going to put up points and it's going to be concentrated on these three guys. And so all these different ways that we can look for these scores that break outside of the normal range that people are targeting. Simply getting 4x production across the board, which is really, really difficult to do from all nine spots. Even simply getting 4x production across the board gets you to 200 points, which is great, but doesn't get you first place in tournaments. Now, this type of thinking is the reason why we have so many OWS members who, after a few weeks on the site or a few months on the site or a year on the site, say that they just got their first 200-point score ever, is because a lot of DFS players don't even think about 200-point scores. They don't even think about first place. Now, they know innately that they need 200-plus-point scores to win a tournament, but their focus in building shifts over to finding good plays instead of finding plays that could help them get to that 200-point level. And all this stuff that we talk about, you know, obviously, like as we've talked about, the research is like a level one type of element with DFS. The level two element is this idea of actually thinking about first place, actually thinking about 200 points. And it's a level that most of our competition never gets to. Most of our competition is just thinking about getting good scores from individual pieces, or even if building around a game environment, they're thinking about getting good scores from a game environment. So level two puts us closer to the people we're really competing against. Who are you really competing against in DFS? You're not competing against the casual player who's putting in four or five teams with a couple hours of research or a couple hours of reading of research, and they're just thinking about getting good players. You're competing for first place, and that means that you're competing against Awesomeo. You're competing against Petty Theft. You're competing against Cubs Fan. You're competing against Blender. You're competing against these guys who put in a lot of rosters and really know what they're doing. So by getting down to level two, where we're thinking about 200-plus points, we're thinking about first place, we're already moving past most of the field and putting ourselves in position for long-term profitability because we're competing against a much smaller pool of players. Level three is the other stuff that we talk about a lot, which is actually how to put these rosters together. How to ensure that it's not just, obviously not just nine random players, but so that the players correlate well, that you're telling a story with the way you put them together, but also, and you could even say that this is level four, taking those players and the way you're building around them and balancing them off of, leveraging them off of what the field is doing. So last week we had some good examples of that we talked about in terms of you know, we had these high-priced quarterbacks that were likely to hit. And so the Russ versus Josh Allen game where they're playing each other, you know, basically what we said last week was we had a lot of quarterbacks that could go for like 25 to 32 points that were higher-priced guys. Russ and Josh Allen playing against each other could also go for 25 points if things broke wrong, but they were likelier to get up to about 40 points. And that was the number that we pegged. And we basically said, if you roster Deshaun Watson, who was priced right next to Josh Allen, if you roster Deshaun Watson, you not only need Deshaun Watson to put up the 32 points that's kind of his ceiling in the game environment he had last week in a likely blowout against the Jags, but you also then needed Josh Allen to finish at the lower end of his range. You needed Russell Wilson to finish at the lower end of his range. You needed them to come in at about 25 points. So the question then became on a Deshaun Watson roster, not just how do you build so that you capitalize on the points if Watson gets to 32, 33 points, right? You bring back Brandon Cooks or Will Fuller. You bring back DJ Shark or Keelan Cole. Not just how do you do that, but how do you also then say, okay, in order for this Deshaun Watson roster to win a tournament, I also need Russ and Josh Allen to finish at the lower end of their range. That was where we talked about, okay, maybe you bring back DJ Dallas on your Deshaun Watson roster and say, not only do I need Deshaun Watson to put up his 32 points, but I also need Russ to get about 25. I also need Josh Allen to get about 25 or 26. How does that happen in that game environment where points are probably going to be scored? That probably happens from the touchdowns coming through other guys besides these guys. And so that's the sort of stuff that we want to be looking for at that level four is how do we balance our roster so that it's moving us toward first place, not just moving us toward a 200-plus point score, but also saying, okay, let me also blend off of what everybody else is going to be doing and what else this slate offers so that if my stuff clicks, in order to get to first place, I also need some other stuff to miss. And so let me capitalize on what will happen if those other things miss as well. Again, that's where this thought of, hey, look, even if you don't love Jefferson or Thielen on a week and you really like Dalvin Cook, if you're building more than two or three rosters and you're going to get a lot of Dalvin Cook exposure, you want to think about also bringing back at least one Thielen piece, at least one Jefferson piece, so that like last week, I wanted 9 Dalvin rosters. Salary didn't allow me to get up to 9. I ended up with 7 out of 19 Dalvin rosters, but I still brought back, I think it was 4 Jefferson rosters and 3 Thielen rosters. Didn't love those plays, but I want to make sure that on the weeks where my Dalvin rosters miss, that I'm still getting those points that are going to come from the Vikings. And so those are all the sorts of things that we want to be thinking about blending together. So why do I not like this week? Well, it's like this. I in one of the write-ups this week, I likened this week's slate to the Thursday night game between the Titans and Colts. And what I meant by that was the Titans were the superior offense because they have a concentrated offense. We know that they're going to give the ball to Derrick Henry, A.J. Brown, Corey Davis, and to a lesser extent, Jonnu Smith. And that's where the touches are going. Whereas the Colts, you can look through their box scores and there are 10, 11, 12, sometimes 13 guys who are touching the ball on the Colts offense on a given week. And so because things are spread out so much more, right? If the Titans put up 75 non-quarterback DraftKings points and the Colts put up 75 non-quarterback DraftKings points, it's much harder to take advantage of it from the Colts because there's so many different guys who could be the ones who get up to 18, 20 points. Furthermore, it's so much more difficult for somebody on the Colts to put up 30 points because they spread the ball around so much. And yet, when you really started digging into that slate, it was still like, yeah, most of these Colts guys can't get up to 30 points. And yet, 2 or 3 of them are probably going to outscore 2 or 3 of these main pieces on the Titans. In other words, I have to basically isolate a 15 to 20 point score and know that that's going to be required to win a tournament. Now, we're talking about a showdown where there's only one game to choose from, but it's a good example because this weekend's slate is kind of similar in my mind, in that this outside the normal range of scoring type of score we usually look for, these 40-point scores, these 45-point scores, these scores that are going to get us to first place in a tournament, they're not as plentiful on this week's slate, which means that some of these 22, like cheap 22-point scores, or these 25 to 28-point scores are going to end up being a little bit more valuable than they are on a normal week. And so one of my biggest edges in DFS that I can kind of pin down and point to week in and week out is that most weeks, a large chunk of the field is targeting good scores. They're targeting strong scores. Even a lot of really sharp players, they don't do a good enough job isolating and really hammering these plays that have potential to break the slate. Now, they're going to end up with those plays, but they spread things out. A lot of our competition, like even our really sharp competition, spreads things out thin enough on plays that are really only going to get them up to 190, 200 points, 205, 210 points. And they're not focused enough on just hammering, isolating and hammering these plays that really could change the slate. And so for me, a week like week 9 set up great for me. Same thing in week 7 set up great for me because I'm essentially going to be a little bit more premium on my focuses than a lot of my competition is. I'm going to be a little bit more focused on saying, yeah, but can this guy actually get me a tournament winning score than the field is going to be focused. And so because of that, if I can find those spots, right, not every spot that I isolate is going to hit, but I'm only isolating spots that can hit. And the spots that are likelier than others, I'm able to see that and go overweight on those plays. And so I'm going to be overweight on Davante Adams. I'm going to be overweight on Dalvin Cook. I'm going to be overweight on Christian McCaffrey. I'm going to be overweight on DJ Shark. And so even like looking back at week 9, I didn't have a huge weekend in terms of payouts, but I built 19 rosters. And 3 of those 19 rosters reached the top 5 in the Wildcat at different points in the day. One of those rosters sat in first place for a little while in the Wildcat. And so I can look at that from a process standpoint and say, okay, perfect. Like I was in position for first place. I did exactly what I needed to do on that weekend. And it didn't click on the small sample size of a single slate on that particular weekend. But you can't ask for more than having, you know, I think I cashed 9 out of 19 rosters or 10 out of 19 rosters and had, you know, 20% of my rosters finished in the top 3% or so. And so if you can have weeks like that where you can pinpoint and say, okay, everything was set up, like I was aligned so that if things clicked, first place was in my sights. That's all you can ask for. And you feel great about, as long as you're playing like that, you know, week in and week out, you feel great about that. And I think I've said that we've had a significant edge on the field through OWS in at least 6 out of 9 weeks this year. And I've had 5 out of 9 weeks this year where I had rosters that were very much in position for first place. And the way that I've been able to beat the odds, so to speak, by such a large degree has been by running into enough of these weeks where I'm able to find the pieces that just have a higher likelihood than the field is giving them credit for of pushing toward those 240, 250 point scores. And I'm able to build a little bit more aggressively around those spots. So this week, let's run through it real quickly. In fact, right, we have the Seahawks against the Rams. Now that's going to be a popular game. It's going to have points, but these players are priced up. The Seahawks are priced up for what they've done on the season. The Rams are priced up for expectations in this matchup. And yet the Rams have been one of the toughest defenses in the NFL to produce upside against. They've allowed the fewest passing touchdowns in the NFL, the lowest average depth of target in the NFL. They've been tremendous at preventing downfield throws. And so will Russ still put up a really solid DFS score? Almost certainly. Will one of his wide receivers put up a really solid DFS score? Almost certainly. But will they get to the type of score that you need to keep you on even a 200-point pace? That's a question mark. Now, it's a question mark. That doesn't mean it can't hit, but it's a question mark. It's more of a question mark than it's been in other weeks. It's more of a question mark than the field will probably assume. Will the Rams come out pass heavy in this one? They could. They absolutely could. They could come out and decide, we're going to throw it 45 times. We're going to try to beat the Seahawks this way. But could the Rams come out and say, hey, look, we are winning games on the ground. That's what we're trying to do this year. And we don't want to get into this back and forth shootout with Russ. We're going to try to limit Goff to 32, 33, 34, 35 pass attempts again. We're going to rotate our running backs and hammer the rock. Could the Rams do that? Absolutely. You know, and then if that happens, all these guys that people are going to be going to on the Rams are going to come in below expectations. And so there's more, not to say that that spot can't hit, but there's more risk in that spot. And if that spot does hit, there's a lower likelihood than there have been in other Seahawks games of that pushing you toward a 240-point score, 250-point score. Bills and Cardinals. The Bills and Cardinals have a over-under of 56.5 as I record this. As we explored in 11 out of 13 games, 11-2 basically, against games, not against Seattle or Miami. These two teams have gone, their game totals have gone under 56.5, a lot of times under 50 points. Can they get over 56.5? Absolutely. It wouldn't be a surprise if they did, but it also wouldn't be a surprise if this game finished at about 48 points. I won't dive into all the reasons why, but you can dive into the NFL Edge write-up for this game if you've missed it. So again, this game could hit, absolutely could hit, but the field is going to overstate the case for this game hitting, and it could just as easily not hit. Furthermore, if it does hit with the way that pricing is set up on these players, it wouldn't be surprising at all if it, quote, hits and the players keep you on, the players, you know, the top players from this game keep you on a 185-point pace, 190-point pace. Again, not good enough to win you a tournament. Now, that doesn't mean those players can't be on a tournament-winning roster because maybe other pieces keep you on that 250-point pace and push you over the top. But it's not going to be the game that drives you to first place in that case, and it's going to draw heavy ownership. So in a spot like that, the general strategy idea is to say, okay, the top two spots on the slate are not as tremendous as top two spots on the slate that we've had in some other weekends, but ownership will still congregate on the top two spots on the slate the way that it typically will. So what do we do? Usually we would just say, cool, let's drop down to the number three spot on the slate. Let's drop down to the number four spot on the slate, grab some lower ownership with just as much upside and try to win the slate that way. Well, what's the number three spot on the slate? I would say that it's the Browns against the Texans. The game opened with an over-under of, I believe, 54.5. It might have been 54. The Texans set up really well in this matchup against the Browns' pass defense, against the Browns' pass funnel defense. The Browns set up really well against the Texans for the way they like to play, keeping the ball on the ground, as we explored in the NFL Edge. If Nick Chubb comes back, it's harder to isolate, again, that top score from the Browns because Chubb and Hunt are both priced up so high that they need to get about 30 and they're going to be splitting reps. It's hard for one of them to get up to 30 points. Chubb doesn't have a pass game role. Hunt won't take on more than 15, 16, 17 touches with Chubb on the field. But let's swing over to the Texans side. Plenty to love there. Brandon Cooks is cheap. Will Fuller is affordable. Deshaun Watson is priced around these other quarterbacks so that, you know, people who are taking these other quarterbacks, Watson essentially provides leverage off of them. But now we look at this game on Friday and the game total has dropped all the way down to 47.5. We have the same wind concerns we had in that Raiders-Browns game a few weeks ago that finished at a 16-6 score. The 25-mile-per-hour winds with 40-mile-per-hour gusts is what we are projecting now. So could those plays hit? Sure, they could still hit. Are they as likely to keep you on a 240, 250-point pace? No. What about Raiders and Broncos? Over under of 51. Actually, I think it's gone up to 51.5 now. But again, the Raiders, how often have the Raiders produced an individual score that has kept you on a tournament winning pace? Darren Waller has basically disappointed against his salary in all but one weekend. Now, the weekend when he hits, same thing last year, right? He always gets like 12 to 14 to 15 points, but he's priced as a guy who needs to get you 21, 22, 23. When he hits, he gets these 29 to 30 point games, but that only happens, I think it happened a couple times last year. It's happened once this year so far. And when he misses, you know, he's kind of dragging down your roster. Jacobs is so touchdown dependent. Against a Broncos team that's given up, I believe it was 3 running back rushing touchdowns on the year, fewest running back rushing touchdowns allowed this season. Swing over to the other side of that game and you have an inconsistent Drew Lock. What should be a somewhat popular Jerry Jeudy. Jerry Jeudy has fewer than 50% of passes from Lock to Jeudy have been completed. And that's not Judy's fault. That's mostly Lock's fault. We talked about his accuracy issues in the NFL Edge this week. The Raiders are allowing the 5th lowest wide receiver target rate. So the chances of Jeudy getting up to 14 targets again are low. We're probably looking at 8, 9, 10, maybe a really good game, 11 targets, and then you complete half of those and you end up with something like 5 or 6 catches for 70 or 80 yards. Great game, but you know there's a lot of risk that you're taking on there for a dud, and that's not winning you a tournament. Even if he scores a touchdown, that's not winning you a tournament, especially at high ownership. Again, they're pushing targets away from wide receivers. Raiders are pushing targets to running backs, but Denver doesn't throw to running backs. They're about league average in targets to tight ends, and so maybe we swing in with Fant. But again, Fant is being used as kind of the short and intermediate piece, where Hamler and Tim Patrick and Jerry Jeudy are all being used downfield. So the chances of getting like a 25 to 28 point score from Fant are lower than we would love, and that's kind of the score you need at his price. And so now we're down to like the 4th spot on the slate. We could swing over to the Packers with their huge Vegas implied team total of 31.25. I think it's down to, it started at 32, and it's dropping because of wind concerns as well. Last time we had wind concerns on the Packers was the same week as the Browns and Raiders, and that was the week where Davante Adams floated his value with 3 touchdowns, but the yardage wasn't there because the Packers were throwing in the shorter areas of the field. And so basically, like, that's the top 5 spots on the slate as far as game environments. And it's possible that no one from those 5 spots keeps you on a 225-point pace. Or I should say that there's no one that you can just target as a blue chip piece. There could be no one from those 5 games that will be isolated as a kind of a higher owned play, or maybe not higher owned, but and in retrospect should have been higher owned play. You know, like the Dalvin Cook a couple weeks ago, Christian McCaffrey last week, the Aaron Jones week, the Joe Mixon week, right? There could be no alpha plays from these 5 games who keep you on that elite pace, which means that the way to get a player from one of these games who could keep you on that pace is to build around the game. But then that could leave you with 2 or 3 guys who aren't keeping you on that pace to get you the one guy who does keep you on that pace. And so basically just this whole week leaves a little bit more guesswork than I like. So my edge is finding the spots where there's less guesswork than the field realizes, and then hammering those spots and building really intelligently around those spots across my rosters, and obviously kind of laying out in the back end of the week for you guys how I'm seeing those things and how I'm building as a result. A week like this, where there's just less certainty across the board, is a really, really, really great week for a player like Cubs fan or a player like Blender, who's going to just play off of uncertainty across the board. And so it doesn't mean that there's not an edge this week. It just means that the edge is a little bit less sharp. It's a little bit less targetable. And we're probably still going to need a 220, 225, 230-point score to win first place in a tournament. But it's much more difficult to pinpoint the places or the games or the sets of players that we can build around in order to give ourselves our clearest shot at that type of score. So on a week like this, you almost have to adjust and say, okay, A, the plays I'm going to isolate might not be keeping me on this. Like I'll set my sights a little bit lower. Maybe they don't keep me on this 230-point pace, but if I can isolate plays that I think can get me on 175, 180-point pace with upside for more, then that's going to have to be good enough. And then I'm going to embrace a little bit more uncertainty than usual in some other spots and just try to find some lower-owned plays. And that's a key on a week like this because, again, ownership is going to congregate on spots that are really less certain than a lot of other weeks. And if those spots hit, fine. But the way to win first place isn't to try to bet on those spots hitting. The way to win first place is to say, okay, if there's less certainty at the top than in other weeks, let me play off of that by letting others attack that uncertainty, that popular uncertainty where I attack less popular uncertainty in other spots. So that's a much longer intro than I intended to lead off with. We will condense things on the bottom-up build in order to keep this to a manageable length. But all of that's important to talk about on this week. And I mean, that's really, you know, we try to not stick to any prescribed set of information from one week to the next. We try to be Belichick-like in our approach. We try to say, what, or now the Patriots are playing so poorly this year, let's call it Brian Dabble-like in our approach, the Bills offensive coordinator. We try to adjust based on what the slate gives us instead of just being hard-headed and saying, you know, this is the approach that we take and we're going to stick to it regardless of what the slate throws at us. And so on a week like this, it's important to dive into stuff like this. It's important to recognize what the slate offers us. And it's also important to see what we want to be looking for on a slate in regards to what the slate offers us. So 30 minutes, longer than we wanted to spend here, longer than I intended to spend here, but all super important stuff for a weekend like this. So keep that in mind as you go into your builds and as you start strategizing on what it's going to take for you to get to first place this week. All right, enough of all of that. Let's go ahead and get to the bottom-up build. Now, again, we're 30 minutes into this already, so I'm going to try to tighten this up a little bit. And frankly, there's a lot of value this week, so there's a lot of different ways that you could go here. I've gone ahead and put together the bottom-up build sort of based around some of the pieces that I'm going to be targeting that we'll get into on the player grid. And in fact, you might be listening to this on the player grid because I'm going to be dropping this into the player grid in addition to the dropping it onto the angles page, because this first 30 minutes that we just covered ties in obviously with kind of what this whole week looks like for me from a player grid perspective, player pool perspective. So yeah, let's go ahead and dive into the bottom up build. And obviously most of you listen to this every week, you know what the bottom up build is, but real quickly, the idea here is rather than starting from the top and figuring out what studs we want to play, which is a huge mistake that a lot of DFS players make, especially newer DFS players, we like to start from the bottom up and get a sense of what value is available and get a sense of the players that we would feel really comfortable moving forward with on the slate. As always, we also like to go from the top back down to try to find those players who, once you drop below them, you end up in sort of just a really different tier of players. That helps us identify also the players who are sort of mispriced. So this week we have 8K in salary left over. So as we've been doing lately, we're also going to build this as if the entire field has 42K in salary to mess around with. And what I mean by that is rather than just blindly building strict value plays, we also have been trying to use this as an opportunity to talk about roster construction, as in what it would take to, what it takes to win a tournament, the type of thinking it takes to win a tournament, whether that's through correlation or through leverage. And so again, as if everyone has 42K in salary, and we not only want to see what the value is with our 50K salary cap, but also see if everybody did have 42K, what would be a way that we could potentially build in order to have some differentiation from the field. So this week's bottom-up build, I'll go ahead and start in the place where most people will start this week, and that is Mike Davis at running back. Now, I dove into this in the NFL Edge this week. I'm not as confident that Mike Davis is an elite value piece as the field seems to be. Now, I will say that probably about 80% of the time this season when I have differed from Hilo in the way I'm seeing something like this, Hilo has been the one who's ended up being right. And I mean, obviously Hilo is not the only person who is high on Mike Davis as a value play, but Hilo's mentioned several times this week that he thinks Mike Davis might be the best value play of the season. From that perspective, we do have a running back who's going to see close to 100% of the running back touches on his team, a running back who's going to see a lot of pass game work. So we're talking about PPR scoring here. Pass game work is extremely valuable. There is a very clear shot for, I mean, Mike Davis got 8 catches just in limited time against the Buccaneers earlier in this season. There's very clear opportunity for Mike Davis to put up 20, 22, 23 points. He doesn't need 30 points. He's minimum priced. It's almost shocking that DraftKings dropped his price as quickly as they did. That's very unlike DraftKings. And so as a minimum priced running back, if he gets you 16 points, he's keeping you on pace for 200. Or if we go that 3X plus 7, again, saying that cheaper plays, you really need more points, and more expensive plays, you need a little bit, slightly fewer points to keep you on that 200 point pace. 3X plus 7 is 19 points. So if he gets in that 16 to 19 point range, you're thrilled with what you are getting from him. My only concern is, or I guess my two concerns here, we've seen Mike Davis have a number of games in this role under 16 points already. Now, those were spots that maybe didn't set up quite as well for pass-catching running backs, but there's still a risk that the Buccaneers completely control this game. We've also seen a number of, as I laid out in the NFL Edge this week, a number of really good pass-catching running backs or teams that do a good job getting running backs involved through the air not produce in this spot. Though again, we have seen Mike Davis himself produce in this spot through the air. The other side here is the reason you would save on Mike Davis is to spend up on Alvin Kamara or more likely Davante Adams. Now, Davante Adams is priced at 9K. He's in a potential blowout. He is dealing with weather concerns. So there is certainly a world in which Davante Adams puts up 26, 27 points and Mike Davis puts up 14 or 15 points, but this super chalky combination still only gets to about 40, 41, 42 in that scenario, which is 3X. It's going to keep you on 150-point pace. Playing Davante Adams and Mike Davis is massively unlikely to sink your roster this week. The floor is awesome on these guys. The floor is awesome on this combo. But from a standpoint of trying to win a tournament, there's a chance that this chalky combo that everyone is going to have is going to end up not being the play that keeps them on pace for first place, and in fact, being the plays that sort of drags them down and requires them to hit higher scores in other spots. And so I am looking for ways to spend that 13K in salary differently. The flip side of that is obviously, as Hilo talked about in the end around, as I talked about in the NFL Edge, as I'll talk about in the player grid, the other way to approach this is to say, I'm going to play Davante Adams and Mike Davis, but differentiate on those rosters. So, you know, bring back Mike Davis with Tom Brady on the other side, Mike Davis plus Tom Brady. Bring back Davante Adams with one of the Jaguars pass catchers or with James Robinson. Now you have a chalky combo that's built very differently than the field is building and more intelligently than the field is building, where everybody else is just blindly throwing in these plays. You can build around the game environment and try to get multiple things right at once and put yourself in better position for first place. So those are kind of the two ways to approach this. This is obviously kind of one of the flex points on the slate, one of the spots that will decide the way that the slate plays out, because it's going to be very popular. Everybody recognizes that Mike Davis is a supreme value. The our ownership projections currently have Mike Davis at like 47%, and that's for the Millie Maker, where ownership is going to come in lower than it's going to come in on, you know, anything with a higher price tag or single entry. So we could see Mike Davis at 65-70% in high dollar tournaments and single entry tournaments. And most people who play Mike Davis will obviously see that as a way to then play Davante Adams. And so recognize that this is going to be an enormously chalky combo, and you either need to build more intelligently around it if you're using this combo, or if you fade it, you need to recognize that you are fading a super popular combo and you need to find a way to maneuver past the field as a result. But Mike Davis, 4K, super, super easy to put onto this bottom-up build, and that's where we will start this one. The next place I'm going to go is I'll actually stick at running back, and I'm going to move all the way up to Miles Sanders, where most people are going to be hitting Duke Johnson at 5K, and that would obviously be the clearest way to build a bottom-up build roster. I'm going to try to find some leverage on the field by moving up to a guy who's also, you know, we're looking at Mike Davis is going to see 80%+ of the snaps. Duke Johnson's going to see 80%+ of the snaps, is going to see both these guys are going to see close to 100% of their team's running back touches. Miles Sanders is another guy who's going to play 80%+ of his team's snaps, assuming he's healthy, which all reports have him healthy, and who's going to see close to 100% of his team's running back touches. He's more expensive at 6,400, but the fact that we get such lower ownership on him, you know, let's put it like this. If we go 3x+7 in the way that we're targeting scores, that means that Miles Sanders only needs to outscore Duke Johnson by 4.2 points to be the better play. If we played out this slate 100 times, Miles Sanders as a favorite against the Giants, or Duke Johnson as a road underdog in a game where a lot of things are strange about that game, right? The Texans prefer to pass, the Browns filter teams to the pass. The fact that Duke Johnson, as Hilo brought up in the end of round, similar to Gio Bernard being the starting running back for the Bengals, it's going to tilt the Texans even more heavily to the air because they're not looking at Duke Johnson as a guy that they can hammer between the tackles 20+ times. So with the weather coming in, it makes it really interesting because it's difficult to see the Texans deciding to just lean run heavy. But then what do they do in the pass game here, right? Do they just lean on Duke Johnson, or do they try to hit short area throws with wide receivers? If we played out this slate over and over again, Miles Sanders is going to outscore Duke Johnson by 4.2 or more points more often than not. And so Miles Sanders creates some really nice leverage here. The next piece I'm going to go to creates further leverage, and that is Brandon Cooks. Now, if there had not been any weather concerns on this game, or if weather clears up before we get to Sunday, Brandon Cooks is just a screaming value on this slate. Again, he's seen 9 or more targets in every game since Bill O'Brien was fired. He has a 12-target game and 3 9-target games. His average depth of target is only 1.8 yards shallower than Will Fuller's. And then even with the weather, as noted already, the Texans, everything sets up for the Texans to throw the ball. Now, if the Texans are forced to throw the ball a little bit shorter, it's less likely to be Will Fuller who gets those routes shortened up and more likely to be Brandon Cooks. Now, obviously, Randall Cobb will see some shorter area looks. The tight ends will see some shorter area looks. Duke Johnson will see some shorter area looks. But the Texans are unlikely to just say, okay, let's just throw to these guys and ignore Will Fuller and Brandon Cooks. They're going to look for ways to get these guys the ball, and Brandon Cooks is the player likelier to see these, you know, maybe his route shortened up to 7, 8, 9 yards downfield instead of 10, 11, 12 yards downfield. If he gets 9 targets in that mid 5K range, his chances for posting one of the highest point per dollar scores on the slate is really are really strong. And if the weather clears up, he becomes really one of the top point per dollar projected plays on the slate. With all the ownership on Duke Johnson, we're going to see much lower ownership on Brandon Cooks. And if Cooks is hitting, it likely means that Duke Johnson isn't hitting. So you get really nice leverage by going to Brandon Cooks over Duke Johnson. And on this bottom-up build, in this imagined slate where we have 42K in salary cap instead of 50K in salary cap, we also get some double leverage here with Miles Sanders and Brandon Cooks. One other piece that kind of ties into all of this is Dallas Goedert at 4,200. Dallas Goedert saw one target in his first game back, which is an outlier. We would expect Dallas Goedert to see anywhere from 8 to 12 targets most games as the number one tight end in this offense. A disappointing game would be 5 or 6 or 7 targets. And so Dallas Goedert, similar to Michael Thomas, similar to Miles Sanders, similar to Christian McCaffrey last week, we get a pretty clear spot where we can find something that's going to make the field more nervous than they should be on a really strong play. Similar to Deontay Johnson a few weeks back, you know, when he came off the back-to-back injury games and we were able to target 29 points from him at 4,200 in salary. So Dallas Goedert at 4,200 in salary, he has 25 to 30 point upside, and even just kind of a floor game from him, we would expect 10 to 12 points in this spot. It's a good matchup for him. Again, the targets should be there. He should be on the field pretty much the entirety of this game. Dallas Goedert plus Miles Sanders also gives you a nice pairing here. They cost 10.6K in salary. You need about 40 to 45 points between the two of them, and they have a decent track record going back to last year of combining for 40 to 45 plus points, and that was with Zach Ertz healthy. So I'm going to throw Dallas Goedert in here and get kind of this player block of Dallas Goedert and Miles Sanders. It's not a true player block. A true player block is where we can say, okay, this team has a really narrow distribution of touches, and we know that a lot of touches are going to these two guys, and one of these two, potentially both these guys hit, but if one of them doesn't hit, it means the other is hitting, and so you get these combined points kind of regardless. A true player block is where you can say, I'm going to get 3x salary pretty much no matter what from these two guys with a clear shot at 4.5 to 5x salary. There are certainly ways that Miles Sanders plus Dallas Goedert could finish below 3x combined salary, could finish below 30 combined points, but most scenarios in this spot have them going for 30 plus, and they have a clear shot at 45 to 50 points between the two of them. Goedert could get 22, 23 points. Miles Sanders could get 26, 27 points. Those are not outside a reasonable range for these two guys, not outside a reasonable range for them to do this together. Again, we should have James Bradbury on Travis Fulgham. That helps out for these two guys. Greg Ward is just sort of an underneath guy. Jalen Reagor is the downfield piece, but we still haven't seen him go over this, you know, 4 to 5 to 6 target range. And so that just leaves a lot of touches going to, or potentially going to these two guys, and a lot of upside for these two guys to soak up. The Eagles are projected for only 3 touchdowns in this game, but it wouldn't be a shock if they got up to 4 touchdowns. And it wouldn't be a shock if these two combined for all 3 or even all 4 of those scores. That's obviously a best case scenario, but both guys are underpriced for expectations, and you can play them together this week. So what we have right now is Mike Davis, Miles Sanders, Dallas Goedert, and Brandon Cooks. We've mentioned Deontay Johnson already, speaking about past weeks, past bottom-up builds. Going to bring in Deontay Johnson again. I'll lay this out again in the player grid, but I'll go ahead and read these off. I've already written up this part of the player grid. Here's a player, so this is not Deontay Johnson. I'm going to go through 4 other players, then I'll go through Deontay Johnson. Player 1, average depth of target of 9.9. Targets in his last four healthy games of 10, 16, 11, and 12. Next player, average depth of target, 8.7. Recent target counts of 7, 8, 12, and 3. Next player, 8.2. Recent targets, 11, 13, 12, 11. Next player, 8.3. Recent targets of 15, 12, 17, and 9. Next player, this is Deontay, 8.5. Recent targets of 10, 13, 15, and 10. So again, 10, 13, 15, and 10 for Deontay against Davante Adams. Recent healthy games, 10, 16, 11, and 12. 10, 13, 15, and 10 for Deontay. Recent targets for DeAndre Hopkins, 7, 8, 12, and 3. 10, 13, 15, 10 for Deontay. Recent healthy targets for Keenan Allen, 11, 13, 12, 11. 10, 13, 15, 10 for Deontay. Last four games last year for Michael Thomas, 15, 12, 17, and 9. To tighten all that up, obviously it's easier to process that while reading it. So to tighten all that up for listening, Deontay's last four healthy games, he has 48 targets and a dot of 8.5. Michael Thomas finished last year with 53 targets across his last four games. Again, Deontay has 48 across his last four healthy games and an a dot of 8.3. That's 0.2 yards lower than Deontay's. Keenan Allen's last four healthy games, he has 47 targets, one fewer than Deontay, and an A dot of 8.2. DeAndre Hopkins obviously doesn't even fit in this group, but just for illustration purposes, he has 30 targets across his last four games, an A dot of 8.7. Again, we've got 53 targets for Michael Thomas, 47 for Keenan Allen, 48 for Deontay. And then the last piece is Davante Adams, who has a deeper A dot than these other guys at 9.9. But we're looking at 49 targets from Davante Adams across his last four healthy games. 49 targets for him, 47 for Keenan, 48 for Deontay, 53 for Michael Thomas. A dot is basically the same for Deontay, actually a little bit higher for Deontay than for Keenan and Michael Thomas. It's 1.4 yards lower than it is for Davante Adams. So across a game with these, you know, 12 targets per game, that's about 17, 18 fewer air yard. Not a significant gap. All of these guys see shorter area looks than, you know, the true Julio Jones alpha type pieces. But these double-digit target games, 8.5 yards downfield, 9 yards downfield, Deontay's right in the same range as a lot of these really high-priced guys. So Deontay Johnson at, again, his price has just remained ridiculously low, $5,200 this week. He's going to be the next piece on our bottom-up build. Now, he doesn't really fit from a correlation standpoint, but sometimes when you can find a guy who's just really underpriced, again, I'm still expecting Deontay's price to keep creeping up to get up into that mid to high 6K range, potentially even as high as the low 7K range. By the end of the season, as long as he can finally stay healthy for multiple games in a row. So when you just find a really underpriced guy like that, feels great to lock him onto a roster. I'll certainly have some Deontay exposure this week. Next place I'm going to go is to quarterback. We're going to throw in Drew Lock. And rather than bringing him back with Jerry Jeudy, we're going to bring back Tim Patrick. Heading into Tim Patrick's missed games with injury, he was the main piece. Last week, he saw 9 targets. Jeudy saw 14. 14 is a lot of targets, but 9 targets is a lot as well. Drew Lock threw 48 times. Now, we expect more like 36 to 40 passes for Drew Lock here. That increases the risk on Lock. It also lowers the target expectations for these other guys. But there's no reason why, you know, people get so focused on what happened in the last week or two. Recency bias drives our perception of things. And the talk, I mean, nobody's saying anything about Tim Patrick. All anyone is saying now is that Jerry Jeudy has clearly become the alpha on this offense. Maybe he has, but we don't know that. It would not be surprising if Tim Patrick came out and saw two or three more targets than Jerry Jeudy this week. Tim Patrick's 4,900 and going to go totally overlooked. So Jeudy might be the slightly stronger play in this spot. But when we're talking about leverage, when we're talking about putting a roster together in a way that we give ourselves a clear shot at first place, going Drew Lock plus Tim Patrick, I'll say it like this. We're already taking on risk by putting Drew Lock onto a roster. Drew Lock will probably be a little bit more popular this week than he was last week, because last week he was a slate winner. If people go to Lock, they're likeliest to go to Jeudy. So going Drew Lock plus Tim Patrick gets us some nice leverage on the field, gets us a very similar projection to what Lock plus Jeudy brings. And as a random bonus, it keeps us under our imagined salary cap of 42K. Obviously, if I had gone up to Jeudy, we would have changed the imagined salary cap. But that's what we have. That's some good leverage with this build, where other people will be going to Jeudy. And we can get to the guy who, you know, if Patrick hits, Judy's probably not hitting. And it hurts the rosters that have Jeudy while exposing us to an upside type of score. Patrick can hit with his downfield role, with his potential for 8 to 10 targets, with his matchup against the Raiders, can hit for 25-plus points in this spot, just as well as Jeudy can. So at this point, we have Drew Lock, Mike Davis, Miles Sanders, Brandon Cooks, Deontay Johnson, Tim Patrick, Dallas Goedert. We're going to wrap up with the Giants defense. No need to dive into that one. That is, once again, kind of the clear lower-cost defense to go to this week. Good defense against an offense that's been turning the ball over plenty in the Eagles. Furthermore, this works really nicely on this roster because most people won't have Giants plus Eagles pieces, Giants defense plus Eagles pieces. But what we're really hoping for from a defense is a defensive touchdown. And because we don't necessarily expect, now the Giants can put up points on offense, but we're not isolating the Giants and feeling really good about their chances of putting up points just because they have such an inconsistent and generally poor offense. If the Giants' defense puts up a touchdown, however, that actually helps Dallas Goedert and Miles Sanders as it keeps the Eagles more aggressive throughout, forces the Eagles to score more points on offense. So Giants plus Dallas Goedert plus Miles Sanders is a unique way to put that together. In a way that most of the field will just avoid because of the generally accepted rules about how to play defense with the rest of your roster. And then that final piece, this flex spot, is going to be Josh Reynolds. Now, Reynolds comes with some red flags. His higher target counts a couple weeks ago, like his bigger role 2-3 weeks ago, came with Tyler Higbee out. And then his targets last week has continued looks came with Jared Goff throwing 61 pass attempts. I think that the Rams are going to come out and try to win this game on the ground. I could be completely wrong about that. Now, that's part of the reason why, as I've talked about, this slate is not a favorite of mine, because I'm generally able to find more certainty than the field is able to find. And I'm often able to find that certainty in spots that the field isn't even on. So it's certainty at lower ownership. You can't ask for more than that. This week, there's just more guesswork in a lot of spots than the field is necessarily going to realize. Obviously, Seahawks against Rams is going to be popular because Seahawks games are popular. If the Rams come out and decide to attack this Seattle defense through the air, then I'm going to be in rough shape on some of my rosters. I'm not going to have heavy exposure to this game. I probably will have some exposure to the Rams passing attack, but it's not going to be a first priority for me. And if the Rams come out and say, all right, we're going to run the ball just like we typically do. We're going to try to win this game with the run game and defense. We're going to try to keep Russ off the field. We're going to try to hide Goff. We're going to limit the passing to 32 to 35 pass attempts. If the Rams are successfully able to do that, There's a good chance that Reynolds sees only 4 or 5 targets in this one. But what I like about Reynolds is he's the downfield piece. Now, Woods can be used downfield a little bit. Kupp can even be used downfield a little bit. But the way that this offense is designed is for Reynolds to be the guy running the routes over top. What has made the Seattle pass defense so bad is how easy they've been, how easy it's been for opponents to hit them for big plays through the air. So Reynolds could actually hit on only 4 or 5 targets. And if this game breaks in a direction where Reynolds is seeing 7, 8, 9 targets, basically, if this game breaks in a direction where the chalky pieces from this game are hitting, it increases the likelihood of Reynolds getting to 7, 8, 9 targets, because it increases the likelihood of the Rams having to attack through the air. It increases the likelihood of them having to attack downfield. So if Reynolds misses, he's 3,500. It's not killing your roster. And Reynolds missing probably means that this game environment as a whole is coming in below expectations, which is hurting a lot of other rosters. If Reynolds hits, you're basically getting the lowest cost exposure to this game hitting. You're getting the best point per dollar score from this game hitting. And there's a chance that, you know, Metcalf or Lockett or Woods and Kupp and everybody that everybody else is paying up for, that they're all getting 2.5x scores, 3x scores, 3.5x scores. And that Reynolds is the guy getting 4.5 to 5x, because again, he's the guy who's going to be seeing the downfield look. So that's kind of the way that I want to start out my approach into this game, is taking a little bit of Reynolds, and then I will have a couple rosters that go a little bit deeper into this game from there. So Josh Reynolds, 3,500, locking him onto this bottom-up build, gives us a final bottom-up build of Drew Lock, Mike Davis, Miles Sanders, Brandon Cooks, Deontay Johnson, Tim Patrick, Dallas Goedert, Josh Reynolds, and the Giants, leaves us with $8,000 in salary. I'll note here that Mike Davis can easily get to 20 points. I'll note here that Drew Lock can easily get to 25 to 30. Tim Patrick has clear paths to 25 to 30. Miles Sanders has clear paths to 25 to 30. Brandon Cooks, especially if the weather cooperates, has clear paths to 25 to 30. Deontay Johnson has clear paths to 25 to 30. Even Dallas Goedert has clear paths to 25 to 30. Josh Reynolds has clear paths to 15 to 20. He has some outside shots at 25 plus points. The Giants are one of the stronger defense plays on the week. So people are going to talk this week about how salary is a little bit tight. Obviously, they're going to talk about how Mike Davis opens things up. But generally speaking, by the time we get to this point in the season, most people kind of get locked into these higher price plays that they want to play, and they don't realize how much flexibility is still available. $8,000 in salary left over with plenty of guys who could hit for huge scores. Somebody brought up in, I think it was an OWS Collective this week, all the sub 3.5K wide receivers who hit last week. Recognize that there are still these big scores that we can target for more affordable pieces. This bottom-up build gives you a good sense of what one of the ways is to go about, or some of the ways are to go about building some of these lower cost, high upside rosters, and allowing you a lot of salary flexibility from there. Now, the last part of this podcast we usually hit is angles that I'm seeing, different ways to kind of maneuver around what the field is doing on the slate. What's interesting is, well, A, the first 30 minutes of this was kind of centered around the way I'm seeing angles for this week, but B, this whole slate is kind of angles to me. And what I mean by that is there's less, well, as I said, you know, there's less certainty at the top than the field is assuming. And typically I love weeks like that. Typically on a week like that, it's like, okay, there's less certainty at the top, so let me go to that third spot. Let me go to that fourth spot and just load up there. And if the top spots hit, fine. Like, that's okay. I don't make money this week. But over time, weekends where the top spot or the top two spots have less certainty than the field is assuming, and you just avoid those spots and build around the third and fourth spots, you're going to make a lot of money over time, because, you know, especially if those third and fourth spots have more certainty than the field is recognizing, they're going to hit more often, you know, they're going to hit often enough to make you a lot of money at that low ownership on the weeks when they do hit, and make up for the weeks where the higher priced or higher popularity spots do hit. On a week like this, where that third and fourth spot also carries uncertainty, the fifth spot also carries uncertainty, it's just a lot of game theory is the way that I approach a weekend like this. Again, that's why a weekend like this isn't one that I like as much. It's not to say that it's not a weekend that has edges. It's not to say that it's not a weekend that has clear paths to profitability. There are certain player types, DFS player types, that love a weekend like this with very little certainty across the board. A player like Cubs fan thrives on a weekend like this. My edge is finding the certainty that most other people are going to miss because of the way that we understand what's going on in all of these games and what's likely to happen. And this week doesn't set up all that well for that approach. And so I am recognizing that. I am not going to force my standard approach on a weekend where my standard approach is less likely to be profitable. And instead, I'm just going to look for different angles, different ways to maneuver around the field. On any Mike Davis plus Davante Adams rosters that I have, I'm going to look to do some other things that are just really different from what the rest of the field is going to be doing. That way, if Mike Davis and Davante Adams combine for 60, 65 points, and they're kind of foundational pieces that you need, my roster, the rest of the places will be very different. And then I'm certainly going to have some rosters with Davante and no Mike Davis, or Mike Davis and no Davante, or with neither guy, to try to gain some differentiation in those spots. And automatically, I'll end up with some lower ownership and lower owned roster constructions as a result. And so, yeah, the rest is going to be covered in the player grid, but I'm going to leave off at that this week because, again, angles is sort of the name of the game for this entire weekend as far as the way that I'm seeing it. And the player grid's going to touch on the pieces that I like, the pieces that I feel most confident in, and sort of the ways that I'm going to be approaching things from there. But for now, we will get out of here. I will see you on the player grid. I will be on the Run to Daylight podcast this week, so I'll see you there. And as always, I will see you at the top of the leaderboards this weekend. Thanks for hanging out. See you back on the Angles Pod next week.